ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Saturday Extra with Nick Bryant.
In 1776, the American colonies declared their independence from Britain. And July the 4th is the country's birthday. So join me, Nick Bryant, for our America at 250 series. Conversations on how the past continues to animate the present with historians and thinkers such as the legendary documentary maker Ken Burns. Search for Saturday Extra on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, coming to you from Gadigal Land. Thank God there are economists still arguing passionately and persuasively that it's possible to refashion our economies to serve the common good. One of these is the celebrated writer Mariana Mazzucato, who joins us later from London to discuss her new book, The Common Good Economy, A New Compass. And to celebrate these days of high football fever, we thought we'd take a few minutes to look at the origins of soccer in this country. The first match in Queensland was played with what was then called a lunatic asylum. Now, I'm just saying. But first, Anna Henderson, Chief Political Correspondent for SBS, with the latest from Canberra, after a whole day's delay to make way for the Starmer drama in London last night. Anna, welcome to the show.
It was dramatic indeed. I was happy to make way for the most up-to-date coverage on some political uprisings in another country.
It was pretty red-hot, wasn't it?
It actually made me reflect on the relationship between Anthony Albanese and Keir Starmer, because they have a very close relationship. And I got to see it up close at 10 Downing Street in Kananaskis in Canada when they were together there as well. Like, they have really brokered diplomatic deals together. Australia's tied itself very much to Keir Starmer's agenda. So it'll be interesting to see how things change with new leadership in the wings.
And talking of his departure, Albanese sounded really, really moved.
I think probably what really underscored it for me was we travelled to Liverpool while we were in the UK, and Anthony Albanese spoke at the UK Labour conference to sort of introduce Keir Starmer on that stage. Julia Gillard was in the audience as well. He sort of saw the two Labour movements and how they work together, but also this close camaraderie, personal friendship. It seemed like in the absence of, you know, a leader in the US who Australia was particularly close to, that it was Keir Starmer who'd become a bit of a, I guess, the diplomatic friend to rely upon.
Do we know what the new man thinks of AUKUS?
Well, we're told, according to Deputy Prime Minister and Defence Minister Richard Marles today, that everything is fine. But I don't think we have yet heard a really clear enunciation. We don't even know who is going to take over, though it does seem like Andy Burnham is going to be the person who does step in. But we do hear, I guess, from analysts and from perhaps the back rooms of military establishment, that these kinds of arrangements don't necessarily change with a change of political leader, even potentially different political party. I think the finer details of that we'll have to wait and see.
Now, look, let's address the looming monoculture. I looked up, you know, the dangers of monoculture, because it sort of struck me that we've had some lessons here from agriculture about what monocultures can do. And what Pauline seems to be recommending for the whole of the nation allows for mechanized efficiency, one authority told me when I searched the net. But monocultures systematically degrade soil, wipe out local biodiversity, and leave entire food systems vulnerable to catastrophic collapse. Nevertheless, that is what Pauline Hanson wants for Australia.
Well, David, I also looked on my dictionaries.
We do our homework on this show.
To do some comparative analysis. And I think that this idea of a culture dominated by a single element or a single reality, something that binds people together, is what Pauline Hanson is putting forward. And it just is going to be really quite interesting to see, once the dust settles on what she had to say last week, how many Australians react to that, because we have heard for a long time the concerns about immigration, and they have been concerns that have been raised, you know, across the political spectrum now as well. It hasn't just been One Nation raising concerns about whether or not the migration process has been well managed in Australia, but this is taking it much further than just there are too many people coming into the country and it's not well managed enough and we don't have enough resources for all of the people who are arriving, if that is the political argument. It's now turned into an argument about how you are supposed to behave when you get to Australia. And some of the rhetoric around that, the suggestion that one in four Australians have trouble with their English language skills, it's totally wrong. But there are a number of Australians who identified in the last census, around one in four, who speak a language other than English, but that is alongside their English language. Yes. Just a few percent said that they struggled with English language skills. So the problem about this debate now is that not only has it become something which is quite hard to pin down in terms of what One Nation is trying to prosecute, but on top of that, there are some facts and figures which are being used in a way that doesn't really reflect reality.
Patrick White's partner, Manoli Lascaris, became a naturalised Australian sometime in the 1950s. He was Greek. And at the naturalisation ceremony, and he never forgot this, he told me about it sort of 40 or 50 years later, he was advised not to speak Greek on the tram. And you just think, okay, right, that's what Australia was then. But there is this interesting difference, isn't there, in the figures. Our anxieties about the size of migration and indeed the kinds of migrants who are coming to this country rise and fall, rise and fall. And there is always somewhere between 20, 30, sometimes a little bit higher percent of people who are deeply troubled by the size of migration or by who's coming. But for decades now, there has been an extraordinarily high acceptance that multiculturalism has done Australia good. I'm a great fan of the Scanlon surveys, and they show it up there in the 80%. But there have been new figures that have come out in the last couple of days, haven't there, Anna?
Look, they have come out and they have, I think, suggested that there is a change underway. I mean, this Lowy report, which comes out annually, is a bit of a temperature test across the country, margin of error considered to be around sort of 2.5%. And what it's documented in the last year is that there has been and is a historic decline in support for multiculturalism at the moment. But I think when I spoke to the Lowy team about this, because I think it's a good point that you're raising there, like what are we actually measuring, that it's still a significant number and that it's still, when wrapped around the other issues that people identified in that report, in terms of the economic pessimism that was also being perceived and that people were feeling, and some of the concerns about what's happening across the world, that it is, I suppose, when you look at a report like that and you're trying to work out why polling might be changing as well, I suppose it is instructive that this decline has occurred. And is there some kind of correlation?
Sure. But what Pauline Hanson is arguing for is opposed by at least 70% of Australians. Why are we so scared of it?
I don't think it's a matter of people necessarily being scared, but I think what we saw today from the opposition leader, Angus Taylor, when he was asked directly, firstly, about the idea of the monoculture, and then pressed in his media event about whether he supported multiculturalism, is that there was a very strange reality that he didn't want to repeat the word multicultural or seem to endorse that word. And it was over multiple questions and answers that I think the media in Canberra realised that he was really studiously avoiding that word. And I think that is a bit of a departure for the opposition, even though there have been policies that have been announced recently, which have been far more in the form of a crackdown on immigration, in terms of, you know, what temporary residents and even permanent residents would have access to if they're not Australian citizens, the Australian values test. We knew they were going down the path of, you know, a tougher border control regime. But now to see the opposition not willing to endorse the concept of multiculturalism is significant. And I do wonder if the One Nation speech hadn't happened last week, if Pauline Hanson hadn't raised this issue, whether or not we would have seen that unfold in the same way today.
It's staggering, Anna. The Liberal Party has lived by the notion of whatever the initial problems are, in the end, multiculturalism is good for the country. That is, that goes back to the earliest days of Menzies. The Leader of the Opposition has explained himself to you, has he?
He's provided a statement later in the piece to further add to his remarks. And in that statement, he says, "I believe in an Australia where everyone respects our laws, shares our values, and contributes to the fabric of our country. That is the type of multiculturalism that we believe in. We reject Labor's multiculturalism, which sees different people held to different standards because of their cultural background. That is how we have ended up with anti-Semitic hatred on our streets, ugly protests on the Harbour Bridge, terrorist sympathisers back in our community, and non-citizens accessing benefits that should be there for all Australians." That's the end of the statement. So now different political parties want to define that word very differently and use it, you know, as part of a political weaponry.
Now, we've only got a couple of moments left, unfortunately, Anna, to celebrate or to note that the deals have been done which will allow the tax changes through.
This is really interesting. So to cap off, I mean, we talked about mocktails and feed up in the lockup for budget. It seems like such a long time ago.
Yes.
The debate was fierce in the interim, and the government's been under, you know, a lot of pressure, and the opposition has applied some of that pressure too around whether the changes were fair and whether they went too far and, you know, painted outside the lines and had unintended consequences. But now we get to a point where the government has made some changes, not hugely significant, but some changes to the initial broken election promise plan. Negative gearing, capital gains tax changes. Got support from the Greens today to get that through. It's already expecting support from the opposition to get the NDIS massive cuts that are planned through to, quote, make the system more sustainable. You know, the government actually, in the course of today, has locked down, it appears, significant portion of its agenda and its savings going forward. So, yeah, quite a moment.
What have the Greens got out of the government?
So the Greens have got a couple of things. They really wanted to extend the inquiry into the National Disability Insurance Scheme changes, those cuts, which was a very short inquiry of just 3 days, and that's now been extended to a matter of weeks. It will report back in August, so they've basically pushed out the timeframe for that. They've got no concessions on actual changes to the bill, but they're hoping that will build sort of public momentum for change. And so they're celebrating that. And they've also managed to make amendments to prevent people from using self-managed super funds as a vehicle for them to borrow money to buy residential property.
Yeah, a tiny little thing, an interesting little tax loophole that they've got shut.
Very, very small. And I think they admit they haven't got a huge amount of additional change out of this, but the opposition is running a line at the moment. Like, what has been done behind the scenes? What don't we know about? Are there things that are secretive about what's been done? So they've raised, suspected that perhaps there are things that aren't public that have been agreed. I don't know the answer to that question. I spoke to Larissa Waters today, and she was very much of the view that everything was open and transparent. But she did say, and I think this is interesting, that she had tried to get something more for renters. So I guess watch this space in terms of whether the Greens are needed to pass legislation again in the near future and if they bring that up again.
Anna, thanks for joining the show again and bringing us up to date with Canberra. I have been speaking to Anna Henderson, Chief Political Correspondent with SBS. And now, coming up, the possibility, perhaps, of one day there being an economy for the common good. The international economist Mariana Mazzucato is a voice raised against the dogma of the last 40 or 50 years that governments should sell up, shut up, hand over to business and leave self-interest to steer the economy. She writes, Much of my work has focused on challenging the outdated economic paradigms that have led us to believe that we are purely self-interested, that value is created by only a few individuals, and that the best a government can do is fix market failures. In best-selling books over the last 10 years, as an advisor to governments and the UN, and as a professor in the economics of innovation and public value at University College London, Mariana Mazzucato has argued that public and private working together can not only solve the biggest problems of our time, but create economies that address the common good. She joins me now. Mariana, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
A decent economy that aims for the common good has been the dream of thinkers and politicians and economists from the beginning of time. What's the common good, and how do you think we could actually get there?
Very good question. In fact, how you framed it is very important, that how do we get there is the point of the book. So the new book doesn't say that there's no theories of the common good. The problem is that within economics, it hasn't actually had any impact. So in political philosophy, from Aristotle to Michael Sandel at Harvard, who's a famous communitarian philosopher, they've been debating this whole issue of, if you have a goal, so Aristotle called it the telos, you also need the polis, not the police, but the polity, right? So the community, the how we all relate to each other along the way matters. Democracy, debate, contestation, you know, the whole kind of parliament, if you want, of actually contesting what the good life should be. Whereas in economics, the way we've talked about good is in terms of correcting a problem. It's not an objective. There's no telos. So it's correcting for what we call market failures. So the idea in economics is that the market is the best way to organize our capitalist system, and every now and then it messes up. We call that market failures, and we expect government to come in and fix the problem. So even the concept of the public good, which sounds good, two words, one is good, is just correcting for something the private sector is not doing. So we expect the government to fill the gap. That's why you might hear words like, you know, the financing gap for the sustainable development goals is, you know, whatever it is, $7 trillion. So that idea that there's gaps to fill mean that we literally, at best, you know, at worst, we don't fill the gap. At best, we just put money into things without really thinking how to shape those things, how to shape the money itself. Money's not neutral. The form of finance matters. So the book argues that the fact that we're in this corrective mode in economics around good, as opposed to an objective-oriented system where the how we all relate to each other, capital, labor, public, private, public, 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 civil society, matters as much as the what we're trying to do. The fact we don't have that framing means that we will always fail in terms of the good results we are going for, whether it's climate, inequality, biodiversity, water. There's a huge hydrological crisis globally. We are not solving it.
The book, which I should have mentioned before, is the new book, is The Common Good Economy, A New Compass. Mariana, you make the point very vividly in the book that there really is no value without government participation, that government is the basis of innovation. It's not the sole agent, of course, of innovation, but without it, you don't have the kind of development which private enterprise congratulates itself on. Have I got the argument right? And if I have, what recognition do you think government should be given for its role in the creation of value?
So in my first book, The Entrepreneurial State, I made that point. And by the way, the point is not that government is a creator of value. It should be. So, you know, it tends to only be with war. So when we have wars, you never hear of things like the 2030 agenda, right? Governments want to win wars quite quickly. That's why even in COVID, we ended up having wartime tools brought in, like the Defense Production Procurement Act that came from the Korean War was used in the United States to procure personal protection equipment. But in normal times, we have very kind of silly and stupid reactive inertial governments that think that it's okay just to subsidize or to have key sectors or to basically just think of a contract as money changing hands from one place to another, whether it's procurement, a public loan, a bailout. So what I argue is that we should learn the lessons from when government takes problems seriously. And unfortunately, those are only related to the military-industrial complex. But if you break down what happened, for example, to get to the moon, that is simply not how we're treating climate change or any of the problems I mentioned before. The first thing Kennedy said was, we're doing it because it's hard, not because it's easy. That's very different from the government speak in most countries. Any white paper you might read talks about facilitating. That means making something easier for someone else. You know, think of a relationship between, you know, a couple. If one is always making something easier for the other one, facilitating, or in economics, de-risking, it's going to be a crappy relationship. You know, one side is going to dominate over the other. So the fact he said, we're doing it because it's hard, not because it's easy, all of a sudden means you need to embrace uncertainty. You need to share risks together. You need to embrace difficulty. Do we have the public service, the civil service that knows how to embrace uncertainty? Or have they been made to fear making any mistake because you'll be in the front page of whatever your newspapers are? In the UK, it's called the Daily Mail, right? So yeah. Whereas venture capitalists are allowed to brag about all the risks they took for, you know, for each success, you have to bear with 8 or 9 failures. Why don't we admit that that's also going to be true for the civil service? So my point is, isn't it weird that government, when it takes a problem seriously, ends up actually fostering huge amounts of innovation? Internet, GPS, touchscreen, Siri, all those things that make our smart products smart and not stupid came from government investments when they had to solve a problem. The internet came about because DARPA, a defense research agency in the Department of Defense, wanted to make sure that the satellites could communicate. GPS came about because the Navy wanted to know where the ships were. Whereas today we just talk about AI, you know, AI for the sake of AI. And actually, if you look at the early history of AI, so early speech recognition, LLM models, they too actually came about when government had problems they had to solve. So what I've been arguing is, A, the history of major technological change has tended to come about through government investments way before the private sector dared to come in. Second, unfortunately, that's only or mainly around military problems. Why can't we do the same kind of ambitious problem solving around areas like climate change, solving problems of how do we build, how do we eat, how do we move, sustainable mobility, and so on, you know, taking it seriously and urgently. And three, when government does actually wake up and do that, it better make sure it's not just socializing risks, but also rewards. What happened in Silicon Valley was that almost all the investments came from government, but then the booty was taken from the private sector. And I'm, of course, not against the private sector. We needed the private sector to get us to the moon. 400,000 people in the private sector across so many industries, aerospace, nutrition, materials, electronics were involved because we had to solve the problems of the astronauts. How would they go to the bathroom? What would they eat? And so on. However, what you had was a very confident public sector that said, here's the problems that need solving. Help us. We're not going to micromanage you, but also you're not going to cheat us. So they put into the contracts no excess profits, which doesn't mean no profits. You don't get to the moon with charity or philanthropy. You need good business, good government, but you don't want to turn it into a gambling machine.
But Mariana, you also make the sort of basic point that if government funding gets a great enterprise off the ground,
oh, yeah,
the government should have a chunk of the action.
Absolutely. And in fact, it does the opposite. It only subsidizes the failures and doesn't then get some of the return. And the example I always give, back in the day, I already started giving the example. Now it's more common knowledge that Tesla itself would never have started without a huge government guarantee scheme, $500 million in a guaranteed loan from the Department of Energy. And that might not sound like a lot of money compared to the trillion that, you know, Elon Musk is making, but this is early stage, high risk, capital intensive phase of the electric vehicle. That's when government stepped in, when the private sector didn't have that money. And how they formulated, though, the loan program made no sense. They said, if you don't pay back the loan, we want 3 million shares in your company. You don't want 3 million shares in a company that doesn't pay back a loan. It's probably not a very good company. Had they said, we're going to get 3 million shares if you're successful after you pay back the loan, the price per share for Tesla between 2009, 2013 went from 9 to 90. That difference, multiplied by 3 million, would have more than paid back the losses in other areas like Solyndra, which was a solar company, got the same amount of money as Tesla, failed, became known for the failure. Everyone blamed government instead of government saying, hey, we got a portfolio, win some, lose some. We're going to make money from some to cover the downside of the others, right? So had they done what I just said, they could have more than paid back the Solyndra loss and the next round of investment. That's what a public venture capital would do. Instead, what they end up doing is socializing risks, privatizing rewards, and just picking up the mess. They picked up the Solyndra mess, and they didn't get a penny out of the Tesla success.
Are there governments in the capitalist West that do that, that take it, cut the action?
Yeah, I mean, the examples I gave, I mean, so all these questions are great, but they're like from my first book. So I'm happy to tell you more about why the common good is, you know, also a different framing. But in the entrepreneurial state, I gave lots of examples, including, you know, in Israel, quite controversial, given that we know where, you know, why they have so much defense spending. But anyway, Yozma has been critical in Israel. It's a public venture capital fund, which was key to the financing of some of the most important Israeli tech companies. And they've been taking royalties out over history. They actually, I'm not even sure they exist anymore, but anyway, they were fundamental to the Israeli startup scene. Also in Finland, there was Citra, any public bank, of course, right? So BNDS is one of the largest public banks in the world, like KfW in Germany, because they are explicitly a bank and an investment bank, but for the public, then they will, by definition, because that's what banks do, retain equity. However, with public banks, I've written about this recently, the problem is there's huge amounts of money. There's about $23 trillion. It's a lot of money in the national banks, about $2.2 trillion in the multilateral development banks. They're not really that outcomes oriented. They just end up giving money to companies when they're kind of failing to save them. That shouldn't be the role of the public sector. And that's where we come to the common good and the mission book that I wrote two books ago. What I think the public banks should be doing is solving problems, working with companies only if they are willing to help solve the problems. That's why I say move away from a picking winners mentality, which means just picking a sector or a type of firm, towards pick the willing. And if they're small companies, they need extra support, but you don't just give small companies support just because they're small, just like you wouldn't give a large company support just because it's big. So how do you choose the willing that will help you solve, whether it's net zero, biodiversity loss, the hydrological massive problem we have today around water? So working with companies, you know, and helping them work with you through a public loan program, that's a very different remit from just saving a sector, which is what happens in the UK, but also in Italy, where I'm originally from. The bank there, the Cassa Depositi e Prestiti, just gives out money to say the steel sector because they're begging for help because they're failing. Whereas in Germany, where I've worked with the KfW, their public bank, their support to the steel sector was conditional that the steel sector invest and innovate and train to reduce the material content of production across the whole supply chain, because Germany actually had a mission around Energiewende.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Maher, and I'm talking to Mariana Mazzucato, author of The Common Good Economy, A New Compass. Mariana, let's roll forward to the new book. And let me ask you, can we ever agree on what the common good actually is?
So it's a great question. And we should remember that since 2015, every country, including Australia, signed up to the so-called Sustainable Development Goals. You can just remember what they are: no hunger, no poverty, gender parity, life below our oceans, climate action, and so on. So it's not up to me to tell people what the goals are. What I did in the book is to say, for countries that even talk about goals, and of course Australia does talk about different goals, how do we make sure we're not goal washing, common good washing, mission washing? We need a compass that holds us accountable to the common good. And what I do is I built a compass, so five elements. The first is to make sure we are actually explicit. What is the goal? Otherwise, you know, we can all be taken for a ride. What are we actually trying to solve? And how can we make it really clear so that we can also know when we're failing? Can we say yes or no, did we achieve it? Had the space race just said beat the Russian space race, nothing would have happened. They had to turn it into a very clear mission to get to the moon and back in a short amount of time. I already wrote about that in my book, Mission Economy, but the rest is what's new. The second element is co-creation and participation. What should the missions even be? So we can stay at a very high level, you know, these goals, and they are the SDGs. I think they pretty much well capture the big challenges, but how do we transform them on the ground in a city, whether it's in Melbourne and Perth and Sydney, to help people actually come together and co-create and make sense and build consensus around the kind of concrete goals. So you might start with climate action, but then you might say what this really means in a city, which maybe is facing poverty, and also you have a lot of kind of just large conglomerates getting all the public contracts. How do you think of missions that make sense to people and have participation? For example, something we worked on in Brazil was making sure that every child in the country had access to healthy, tasty, and sustainable school lunch and breakfast as well. And there was a lot of participation from the schools, from the mothers, and so on. Or in Camden, my part of London, we worked on a mission on adult social care, and we brought the carers who had so much experience, their lived experience on the ground, knowing why the care system did not work. They helped co-create and with true participation, not tokenistic participation, in bringing knowledge on how to do outcomes-oriented adult social care across 10 housing estates of social housing. Third element is sharing knowledge. There's no point in talking about missions and co-creation if then all the knowledge that we're creating, the learning, the information, the data, gets privatized. So in a world where we like to use big words like collective intelligence, open innovation, innovation ecosystems, the truth is that we are increasingly privatizing knowledge. So we're not turning whether it's our governments, our communities, our ecosystems into learning organizations. And so that's absolutely key. And we saw during COVID how much the knowledge that, you know, was critical for vaccine production was not socialized. In fact, companies like Pfizer completely refused to do it, whereas AstraZeneca was forced to share the knowledge because the publicly financed Oxford University researchers put it as a condition. The fourth element is sharing rewards and examples like the one we just said with the equity deals and so on. And the fifth element is transparency and accountability. Like if we don't even know who's doing what and why, who's earning what and why, and you have too many consultants in the room and intermediators and so on, then things get so murky and untransparent, it's impossible to govern the system for the common good. So these five elements to me are, how do we hold the common good to account so we don't get common good washing? And personally, I think you have to have each and every one of the elements in place. You can't pick and choose. You can't just do the mission without the co-creation, because also it won't stick. It won't go beyond an electoral cycle because people won't care. You can't have co-creation if then the sharing of the rewards aren't there. What's the point of people, you know, co-creating and participating if they don't get any of the rewards? So I can't think of any one of those elements that shouldn't be there if we use words like common good or public interest, public value, you know, governments working in a mission-oriented way. So for me, this was really about, after I learned how easy it was for my work on both the entrepreneurial state and missions to get sort of captured, and governments would love the words but end up using them as slogans, this to me is to hold governments and business to account when they talk about purpose, missions, and the common good.
But Mariana, I ask again a question I asked early on. I can just see the ranks and ranks of opponents to what you're saying. Those those who want to exploit the system, those who want to profit grossly from the system, et cetera, et cetera. How do you get there? How do you go from an extraordinarily attractive argument to a society that will give its government the authority and the talent to do what you're suggesting?
Again, a great question, and that's actually why I'm quite tired, in the sense that I bust my actually training civil servants globally. It's too easy just to write a book and then to go do a TED Talk or to, you know, go on the news, have a great conversation with you, and then, you know, go have a drink. What I've done is I've actually set up a whole institute at UCL, University College London. It's called the Institute for Innovation and Public Purpose, where we're literally rewriting the curriculum for civil servants away from this idea that at best they can fix a market failure and they're just there to redistribute, to facilitate, de-risk, enable, all these really boring words. What does it mean to care about pre-distribution as much as redistribution?
Yes, now explain that. Explain pre-distribution.
Yeah, I mean, so much of government energy is wasted fixing the mess afterwards, including reducing inequality when we create very unequal systems. That's redistribution, right? Through tax. You want progressive taxation. Well, if there's a progressive government, you have a progressive government. I'm assuming for this part of the conversation, we're assuming that redistribution is even seen as something important. And of course it is. However, it's too late. If one continues to allow what happened again in Silicon Valley, socialization of risk, privatization of rewards, which then allow the tech companies to earn the huge rents. I use the word rents and not profits, because rents are excess profits, earning in excess of what you've actually done. Then it's very hard to actually redistribute back to the fair share, given what everyone did. If instead we do pre-distribution, which means how we create value from the start, has the right level of wages, the right amount of money going into the public coffers, given the public sector risk-taking, the right amount of, again, co-creation from local communities. I've worked a lot with indigenous communities, traditional peoples in the Amazon and Brazil, and they say, can you please stop condescendingly just create something like the Amazon Fund, which sounds great, like you're going to do things for us. We should be at the table designing and governing that fund. And I give also examples from Australia in the book where there's similar issues. So how do you get that participatory co-creation, sharing knowledge, sharing rewards? These are all ways to pre-distribute those parts of the elements I talked about before. So we at least minimize the level of inequality, not just in income, but also in voice, that we have ex post. So we don't have to waste so much time. But coming back to your excellent question, that requires training. I often joke that I come in as an economist and I walk out as a therapist, because it also requires confidence, literally the confidence. If government has no confidence and is just bullied constantly from the Pfizers of the world, but it shouldn't, you know, it's not just Pfizer, it's a lot of the tech companies too that are saying, oh, if you, you know, change the rules and have more regulation, or in different sectors, you know, influence how the intellectual property rights scheme is structured, then we're going to leave. If governments can actually get together, especially the so-called coalition of the willing, so different types of progressive governments really thinking together these issues of pre-distribution, then we can also start learning how to do this better. But the training that we provide is literally at the level of, what is government even for? What is collective value creation? What's a creative bureaucracy instead of an inertial bureaucracy? Yeah. How do we get that flexibility, the agility that they had to get to the moon and back? They had to change their whole bureaucracy inside NASA because they realized that they were very siloed between departments. And I tell that story in Mission Economy, which was quite tragic. It was actually one of the astronauts who died in one of the Apollo programs. His name was Gus Grissom. While he was burning to death in the lunar module, he said, will we ever get to the moon if we can't even talk between two or three buildings? Because they literally couldn't hear what was being said in Mission Control Room. And on the back of that, NASA literally changed how it organized its internal organization to be more, you know, different project managers, each with their high-level delegated teams, but in constant communication with each other. So that kind of agility, flexibility. We're currently actually developing an index through the Institute called the Public Sector Capability Index. It's a program funded by Bloomberg Philanthropies, working with over 1,000 cities, trying to better understand also at the super local level, what are the capabilities, the capacities that mayors and their teams require to work in an outcomes-oriented way to solve problems, whether it's floods, droughts, but also, you know, organizing the Olympics or a carnival in Rio.
Yes.
What are the dynamic capabilities, not the static cost-benefit analysis, net present value, which would have never gotten us to the moon had they done a cost-benefit analysis of that.
Mariana, I know that tax is an important part of your argument, and we haven't got time to go into it in much detail, but there is one point I would like to ask you about, because it matters politically very much in Australia at the moment, where we're going through modest tax reform. It is said that tax kills innovation. Do you see evidence for that?
First of all, that doesn't mean anything because there's so many different taxes, right? So there's
but if you raise tax, the taxes.
So put it this way, just even empirically, in the year that both NASA, right, and DARPA formed, these are two organizations I mentioned during the course of the interview, the top marginal taxation rate under General Republican President Eisenhower, okay, was over 90%. That's the top marginal rate. So not the total rate, obviously, the top marginal rate. So that is the same year that the U.S. was in probably one of its most innovative kind of periods in history. Obviously, that doesn't mean that's what we should do now. That just means let's actually look at history, get proper evidence. What we know is that what you need tax for is especially to incentivize behavior in the right direction. So, for example, if you have a capital gains tax where the time that the investment has to be made in order to get a capital gains tax reduction is too low, then you're basically fostering short-termism. And what you need in order to actually drive long-term investments, and almost all the examples we've given so far, internet, nanotech, biotech, clean tech, AI, have required patient long-term capital, what you require is a tax system that rewards that patience. Or if we want a greener economy, you want to make sure that we're not currently taxing labor more than we're taxing the material content, as in many countries is the case. Corporate income tax, by the way, most companies actually don't even pay that. They, you know, most incomes of the large, you know, executive managers, for example, they're paid in stock options. That's precisely why we need to make sure that capital gains tax is working well, because otherwise we're allowing so much of the income earned through stock options. Elon Musk's whole income is basically through stock options. If capital gains tax is too low, we're allowing a very extractive form of economy. But this isn't about high tax, low tax. Is how do you have within the tax base a smart taxation system that is stimulating innovation, right? And just having tax really, really low doesn't stimulate innovation. That stimulates inequality. Warren Buffett is not known for his communist tendencies. And he said, "Can you please stop reducing my tax? That's only increasing inequality." He said, "I invest when I see an opportunity." So the real issue is what can governments do using both taxes, but also all their levers, which include procurement, which is often 20% of a government's spending, to really kind of catalyze the sense that there's opportunities, that there's new markets, that there's new technologies out there. And that ultimately is what stimulates good business investment. If businesses are just trying to come in and leave, that's when they just care about tax, right? Because they don't care anything about the real economy in a particular place. They just want to go in and out quickly. That is not the kind of business you want to be attracting. If you want innovative businesses who come and stay and help form a whole innovative ecosystem, let me give you an example. Denmark, which is tiny, is today the number one supplier of high-tech green digital services to China. And the way that particular kind of innovative green digital service economy formed was through Copenhagen, the city, wanting to be the greenest city in the world. They used all their levers on the demand side to help the startups scale up. They scaled up. They worked with their national champion, also Vestas, a large renewable energy company. And between both servicing the city on the digital side of sustainable mobility, sustainable housing, and so on, and working also with this large national champion, they ended up forming this amazingly innovative economy that now is servicing China's $5 trillion attempt to reduce the material content of production across the whole manufacturing base to reduce pollution, which is huge there. So that didn't come about because they had low tax. Look at the tax in Denmark. It is not low. It came about because they were very smart in how they used all their different levers, from subsidies, tax incentives, procurement, and so on. But any country that says, or any business that is saying, if you reduce tax, you'll kill innovation, is just dogma. It's not true. But what you want is also not the opposite. You don't want to just increase tax. That's also not smart. You need to really be thinking through the different types of tax policies that can help shape the market to be more innovative, more sustainable, and definitely more inclusive.
Mariana, thank you for joining us on the show.
Thank you very much.
I've been talking to Mariana Mazzucato, author of many books arguing what we've been discussing tonight, but most recently The Common Good Economy, A New Compass. And Professor Mazzucato is in the University College London, where she heads the Economics of Innovation and Public Value. Coming up, the ancient roots of soccer in this land. Greeks and Italians arriving after the war weren't the first to play soccer in Australia. There's evidence that at least as early as the 1870s, football matches were being played out here under the British Association rule that the ball not be handled nor carried. Historian of the game, Ian Syson, writes that soccer in Australia has boomed a number of times in the last century or so. Yet, for all of the spikes of interest in the game, it's always receded into the background just when success seemed close at hand. Well, there is a mighty spike of interest now, and Dr. Syson, retired academic, author of The Game That Never Happened, The Vanishing History of Soccer in Australia, joins me to discuss the history of the game. Ian, welcome to the show.
Yeah, good evening, David. That was very eloquent and accurate, what you said in your introduction there.
What I aim for at all times. Hey, Ian, what is the best evidence for the earliest soccer match on the continent?
The undisputed earliest evidence is 1875, and it was a game that was played at a lunatic asylum, as they called it back then, in Goodna in Ipswich, near Brisbane. It was described as being, you know, the way you described it, no hands, kicking off the ground only. And the corroborating evidence that I found for that game was in an Australian rules journal down here where they had a little asterisk next to that game. They tried to document all the games in Australia and it said asterisk association rules. And so that sort of confirmed or that triangulated the assertion. But there are many other games that are still up for investigation, that are still under a shadow, under a kind of doubt.
Yeah, yeah. Who brought the game to Australia? Who was playing it?
The people back then conceived of four separate codes of football, you know, soccer, Australian rules, rugby. Well, that's three, but there's only three at the time. They didn't really conceive of football that way. Football was football. The point of the game was to get the ball between the posts.
Could you just turn up at the field and decide what the rules would be? Oh, look, we're going to play today.
That's often what happened. I think in Melbourne, and that's my best knowledge is of Melbourne. In Melbourne, the first games were played very much in a free-for-all rules. That was very much like each of the codes. What's celebrated as the first game of Australian rules at Yarra Park could have led to any game. The rules were so little, so few, and so vague.
Maybe you turned up at the ground and looked at the condition of the ground, and the harder the ground, the more likely you were to play soccer.
I think that's possibly the case. And again, it wasn't like there was this game called soccer that was available for them to play. It was football, and it was football that involved getting the ball to one end of the ground. And through the goalposts. It was like soccer anyway, the original Australian rules games.
But now, look, I want to ask you about the First World War and your search for the soccer-playing Anzacs. Now, what's the point of identifying which soldiers were ever involved in a soccer game?
When I first started researching the game around the late 2000s, I found this photo of the Irimpel soccer team. And unlike a lot of photos, it had names below them, so that was really handy. But this photo also had asterisks next to some of the players. And below the photo, it said, killed in the First World War. And there were five of them. I thought, my goodness, that's a devastating story. And how comes I don't know about it? How comes nobody seems to know about it? So I thought, well, maybe there's more of it. And I did indeed find so many more. So I thought, let's do a database, start with a database and try to list all the players who were playing and then who signed up. And then the inevitable question is, were they killed?
Yep. Well, tell us the story of the Lowe family brothers.
The Lowe, they were from Scotland, and there was four of them, four brothers. they all joined up. The first one was the youngest, and he went to Queensland to join up. He ended up being killed at Gallipoli. The three other brothers all end up serving, and the last one who wasn't going to go, you know that tradition of one brother staying behind?
Yep.
He decided to go and avenge Huey's death, and he made it back. The interesting thing about this family and the way it relates to your previous question is that when one of them died sort of natural causes in 1927, there was no acknowledgement in the St Kilda paper by the club of the death. There was no funeral notice. There was no memoriam notice. And I'm thinking that's kind of weird. But again, it's about the game is falling apart in 1927. You know, most other sports and sports clubs would have been celebrating their servicemen.
There was no voice.
He was a Victorian representative as well. He played for Victoria and there was nothing.
How many soccer-playing Anzacs have you identified so far?
Well, we're still working in the realm of not so much guesswork as estimation. We figured that there were about 6,000 or 7,000 players in Australia before the war, and so we were working on a 70% enlistment rate because soccer players were very loyalist. A lot of them were English and Scottish,
yeah,
or from English and Scottish families. So we're looking at around 5,000, and at the moment we have 820 on the website, which for those interested is SoccerAnzacs.com.au.
Are you going to be arguing that soccer is the real sport of the Australian troops of the First World War?
No, certainly not. Wouldn't have the audacity to argue that. However, what I would argue is that it's equivalent. It was as popular as all of the other codes. Interestingly, rugby league wasn't very popular in the battalions. But soccer and Australian rules, an equal number.
A common theme of your work is Aberdeen. And there is somebody whose name interests me a great deal, Alexander Sandy Marr of Aberdeen.
Well, he came to Western Australia. He was a goalkeeper. I think he was a bit of a chunky lad. He was a goalkeeper, but he was good enough to represent Western Australia. I think he might have even represented Australia a couple of times.
We've only got a couple of minutes left, and I want you to tell us the story of the soccer ashes.
When Australia resumed playing New Zealand after the war, they decided to establish a trophy. Now, the trophy was made of beautifully designed little casket from woods from both countries. Inside was a razor case that contained the ashes of cigars that were smoked at the smoke social after the game.
Right.
The razor case was at Gallipoli on the morning of the 25th. It was with a guy called William Fisher, who was on the first boat to land, and he describes the landing. And they were very fortunate because they were there first and nobody noticed, so the Turks weren't shooting at them. They were shooting at the next guys. And this razor case that he carried ashore makes it into the trophy. They soldered up the case and with the ashes inside. And so I think that the game should be or could be very proud of the fact that it's actually a Gallipoli relic in that trophy.
But it was found after being lost for ages in somebody's garage.
It was lost in order to protect it. The guy who was running soccer in Australia then, he had possession of the ashes and saw the Europeans coming in to the game and starting to dominate it. And he, I think he put it to one side. He died a few years later and nobody knew what it was about. So they just left it there in his cupboard. And it wasn't until the son died that the grandson saw it and thought, what are we going to do with this? And he reported it to Football Australia. So it's a marvellous story.
Ian, in one sentence, is current passion for soccer going to die away again?
It's going to die away, but it's going to come back.
Ian, thanks for joining us on the show.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Dr. Ian Syson, author of The Game That Never Happened, The Vanishing History of Soccer in Australia, who will, when he has all the material together, publish his book on the soccer Anzacs. And that's the show. On our next, after intense pressure from the United States, UN peacekeepers are being withdrawn from southern Lebanon, where the Blue Helmets, as they're known, have served for nearly 50 years. What this means for the never-ending violence in that corner of Lebanon, we'll be discussing with someone who's served there and is now a human rights lawyer. And we're looking at the ethics of bringing extinct species back to life. It seems possible now, but do we play God with nature and restore the thylacine?
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.